into sports.
20 yards out, Urch to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Now, hopefully an interesting conversation for you. So in 1999, the Associated Press placed the person we're going to be talking about third on its list of top athletes of the 20th century, following Babe Ruth and Michael Jordan, no less. In his 1953 obituary in the New York Times, he was described as probably the greatest natural athlete the world has seen in modern times. And we are talking about Jim Thorpe, a man I know very little about. And I suspect if you're listening in, you're probably in the same category. But fear not, because we have with us Kate Buford, author of Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Kate, you're very welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you. Talking about one of my favorite subjects.
Well, it's great to have you with us. You were just saying to me before we started, you spent a couple of years in Trinity College as well. So you know your way around Dublin.
I do. Well, at least I did. It's changed a great deal, but yes, I love dear dirty Dublin, as we used to call it.
So Jim Thorpe, I must confess, totally new on me for such revered figure, you know, based on some of even the comments I've just read out. So where do we start with Jim Thorpe?
Well, I think the obituary that you quoted was the New York Times, I believe, as probably the greatest athlete of at least that point in time in 53. He's incredibly important because he starts at the dawn of organized sports, really. Organized baseball in the U.S. was pretty much organized in the 1880s, 1890s, but there was nothing else. Football was kind of a ragtag sport, boxing. You didn't have the whole world of organized sports. Onto this scene comes this amazing natural athlete. He was a great natural athlete, but he did practice and train. So what really put him on the map were the 1912 Olympics. We'll probably get into that. In a minute, where he won both the decathlon and the pentathlon by huge scores. Now, we take, now, it's sort of for granted at the Olympics. We look for one of those great athletes to emerge every 4 years. And when he did this, the Olympics, the modern Olympics, this was only the fifth Olympiad. And the previous four had been really plagued with snafus and glitches. And Sweden in Stockholm ran a beautiful Olympics. So he set the gold standard for an amazing athlete coming out of seemingly nowhere and astonishing the world. So he becomes the first international celebrity athlete. And we take again, we have so many of them now, but back then, no, he was it. And rightfully so. He was also a great American football player. He becomes the gold standard. So you may not know much about him, but your grandfather did. My grandfather did. He became this folk hero, really, in many ways, although based on real exploits, of this super athlete who could do anything and do it better than anybody else. So he becomes that gold standard, even years after he stopped playing. So when he dies, as you mentioned, in 1953, the Times can still say, this was the greatest of all. And he remains the greatest multi-sport, I think, athlete ever.
Just how dominant was he at those games in 1912?
Oh my gosh. He was, well, you know, you have to think about the pentathlon and decathlon events. Those are multi-sport events. And they were meant by, well, the pentathlon, both of them, by the ancient Greeks, shot put, pole vault, all of the different events, meant to showcase all the various attributes of a great athlete. So you're not just doing one sport. You're not just running faster than anyone else in one sport. You're doing all of these different activities. He scored hundreds of points ahead of the second place winners in both the pentathlon and the decathlon. It was astonishing. Everyone expected a Brit or a Scandinavian to win those events because they were very good at track and field. But they couldn't keep up with Jim Thorpe.
Yeah. Amongst other attributes or abilities. I was reading he could run the 100 yards in 10 seconds flat. He could do 220 yards in 21.8 seconds. He could run the mile in 4 minutes 35. So he's a sensation, really. You mentioned he trained as well. Was he a ferociously hard worker? Or I guess he has to be a touch gifted at the outset.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Again, a myth that grows up around him, which was sort of like sour grapes or whatever, was that he didn't train. Like, and often this is a kind of myth that grows around athletes that come from ethnic groups, like they have some magic, like African runners, you know, that nobody else has. Whereas in fact, they're just very good runners and train hard. He would train, but he had a philosophy about training. He didn't want to overtrain and get what he called stale. So he would train to his capacity, and then he would kind of relax and let it set in. He also was, and this is important now, because people do it routinely now, athletes, he would visualize what he wanted to do in an event in his head, which a lot of Native Americans did. They would watch someone else do something, and then they would do it, but they'd watch really carefully. And he was doing that actually on the ship that sailed to Stockholm. He was watching. He never really was a discus thrower or pole vaulter. He was a pole vaulter to a certain extent, but he wasn't trained in those. He just watched people who were good at it and then did it.
And around that time, what was the status of a Native American in the States? Well-received, well-treated, or on the receiving end of not such nice treatment?
It depended pretty much by and large, not such great treatment. There's a whole historical background, which we won't go into here because it would take up the whole time. But yes, horrific treatment historically, deprived of their lands, discriminated against, looked down upon. But an important thing to remember, and I bring this up in the book, is that anyone who was not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, shall we say, was considered lesser. Since Jim Thorpe's reputation remained so strong was that so many people identified with him. Italian athletes, Irish athletes, African-American athletes, Jewish athletes, anyone who was not in that mainstream power structure and had all the advantages of that was considered lesser. So, but in addition, he had a special case. He'd gone to one of the Indian boarding schools, Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which was a boarding school for Indians, part of a reform project to try and really quite blatantly turn Indians into whites. And I'm using the term Indian because that's how his family describes themselves. So, and he got preferential treatment because his coach was the famous, to be famous in this country, Pop Warner. Jim, as has become common, you know, got preferential treatment as an athlete at Carlisle with other Indian athletes. So he had a kind of oblique sort of experience as a Native American. But to fully answer your question, I think in general, his athletic superiority trumped in many ways his identity as an Indian. He was so superior that he was the exception that proved the rule. And he was treated as such.
Okay, because I think people often remember the image of Muhammad Ali after Rome throwing his medal in the river when he's refused entry to a restaurant after winning gold for the States. So Jim was celebrated. I know there is a fall quite soon after the games, but he is celebrated. He's a national figure. He is the exception to the rule.
He's an international figure. I mean, because it was the Olympics. And the Swedish Olympics, as I mentioned, were the first really well-run Olympics. So they set a model for how the Olympics would go forward in the 20th century.
Mm. So within a month, it all starts to fall apart.
Sure does. Well, a few months. The Olympics were in the summer of 1912. And in January of 1913, an enterprising reporter in New England, near the Boston or Massachusetts area, found out that Jim Thorpe had played professional baseball for 2 summers. And in those days, as some of your listeners may be aware, amateurism was a huge issue. And the Olympics were supposed to be purely amateur. You were never supposed to have accepted money for sports. You were supposed to be pure, Simon pure, as they say, from any compromising monetary transaction, that only people who could afford to could compete who could subsidize their own training. He had left Carlisle School to go and try to break in to Major League Baseball, which was, as I mentioned, the only sport that was really organized, had contracts, paid well. So he took off for North Carolina for two summers to play in minor league, what we call here, you know, minor league, not the majors, but the sort of farm teams for the majors, hoping to be scouted and to come up and join a major league team. He wasn't good enough. I mean, baseball's really hard. Frank DeFord, the late great Frank DeFord, great sports writer here, an observer, told me once that there's something about that little white ball that can frustrate even the most competent athletes. Mm. And it sure frustrated Jim Thorpe. He'll surmount that, but not yet. What happens is that in 1913, the humiliation the U.S. Olympic team felt, that this great, amazing athlete, you know, lauded by the whole world, had been shown to have violated the standards of amateurism. And Jim Thorpe did sign a form, it's in the book, testifying that he'd never accepted money for sports. And he was probably coached by Pop Warner to do that. Pop Warner calls all the shots in this, I should say. And well, this is a scandal. And within a week, I mean, it was huge, huge deal. Within a week, he is forced to send back his two gold medals and the trophies. There were these gorgeous big trophies that the Tsar of Russia and another monarch, again, very aristocratic at the time, these were challenge trophies that were meant to be turned back in 4 years later. The official record of the Olympics, which won't be published until the summer of 1913, expunged all his records, which of course were so amazing. And the second place winners of each of those events, pentathlon and decathlon, were then elevated up to first, second, and then the fourth place went up to third. It was right. I mean, he had violated amateurism, but as many people said, well, what does baseball have to do with track and field? But it was the principle of amateurism that was so pervasive then and so class-ridden. And again, all those people I mentioned before, all those people who identified with this outsider who came in and beat the big boys at their own game, they were furious. I mean, they really felt in the larger scheme of things, he had been robbed.
That's a devastating blow. How does Thorpe cope?
He described it as a nightmare. He was a very stoic fellow, not demonstrative at all, not a man. As he used to say, if I'm talking, I can't listen, which is, we'd all be good to keep in mind. It was a nightmare because of the public scrutiny. You know, all these reporters, all this news coverage. He had hoped to finish get his diploma at Carlisle, take care of his family. He wanted to be married. He was actually going to be married soon. The public scrutiny, the public glare, as I called it in the book, would haunt him for the rest of his life, because reporters would knock on his door until almost the day he died saying, well, how's the great Jim Thorpe doing? And you can imagine what that was like. Almost immediately, Pop Warner, quite the opportunist, figured out a contract. And of course, he was being besieged by, Jim Thorpe was all the major, or most of the major league teams. They wanted this great athlete. Not that he'd done so well in baseball, but what they called the publicity value, you know, that he would bring people to the stands to see the great Jim Thorpe play baseball. So a contract is signed with the New York Giants, which was a enormously successful and powerful team, sort of like the New York Yankees in their heyday. And Warner got a cut, and Jim almost immediately gets dropped into Major League Baseball. And we can talk a little bit about that, but you can imagine, here's Thorpe, wonderful athlete, signs this very lucrative contract, but he was never really good at baseball. And he's in a major league team. He's not getting warmed up like Jackie Robinson did, warmed up in the minors before he went with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So he predictably does not do that well, which only exacerbated, to follow up with your question, the agony that he was in. It was awful, really awful.
He spends about 7 years playing baseball professionally?
Yep. He spends about 7 years. And what's really interesting, what I discovered and had not been mentioned before, he was farmed out to the minors by McGraw, who is the John McGraw, a good Irishman, who is head of the New York Giants. And he slowly, what you need to get better is times at bat. You need to be playing. You can't just be sitting on the bench. So in the minors, he played and slowly, slowly, slowly got better and better and better. So by 1919, he could hit off of both left and right-handed pitchers. He was hitting as well as, these are two greats and people are following baseball that are listening, Ty Cobb and Shoeless Joe. He was at the top of the league hitting as well as they were in the summer of 1919 until an injury took him out of the contention. So what's really interesting here is that this was a sport he did not play naturally well, but he worked really, really hard and became very, very good. So
that's impressive. And does that injury end him then, 1919?
No, it just took him out of that season. It was just a pulled leg muscle. I can't recall exactly what it was, but it was enough that for those few weeks that were left of the season, he couldn't be competing at Ty Cobb and Shoeless Joe Jackson's level.
Okay. But,
because another myth about which John McGraw, the Giants manager, perpetuated, is that Jim couldn't hit a curveball. So this kind of moniker, this kind of label gets attached to him, but it wasn't true. He couldn't hit a curveball in 1913, but how many people could if they were dropped into the majors? In 1919, he could hit anything.
And why does he stop playing baseball?
Well, he goes on, he plays baseball in very minor league teams in the 1920s and some non-official baseball teams. He keeps playing two sports at least. Football, we haven't spoken about football yet, but he plays two sports, even 1 year, three sports with basketball until 1928, when he really realizes finally that he's done. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to Hollywood.
So. Well, of course. I mean, of course, naturally. And what heights did he hit with football?
Well, football, American football, I should say. He was a huge star at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. And this is before any kind of organization governed collegiate football. Pop Warner, ambitious Pop Warner again, got Carlisle on the schedule of Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Penn, Georgetown, all of them elite, upper class, Ivy League, except for Georgetown, colleges. And so the Indians, the Carlisle Indians, as they were called, played against these top teams. And Jim was a phenomenon. I mean, just amazing. Particularly when he comes back to Carlisle in 1911 and 1912 are two amazing football seasons where Jim, they beat Harvard, they beat everybody, almost everybody. They never had a completely pure season. And so football was really his favorite sport. I mean, Pop Warner left him alone. I mean, he would be on the field, excuse me, and Jim just had that kind of brain that could see the whole game and respond accordingly. He already was a great football player and was really better known for that, at least at the collegiate level. And football, American football at that time, was only a collegiate game. Professional football was this sort of, they called it the reptile sport because it was professional. Again, we're getting back to that amateurism issue. So these teams began, the sport really begins in Pennsylvania, migrates to Ohio, migrates west to Ohio, and professional football starts locally in small towns and they field teams, but it's not really recognized at all. It's not really making much money. Jim Thorpe is asked in, oh, I've forgotten the exact year, but let's say it's 1916 or so, to come and play and coach for the Canton, Ohio Bulldogs. And because he's this incredibly well-known athlete and very good at football, he helps to put professional football. And in 1920, they decide they really need to form a league, like baseball has leagues. And they form, it's 2 years later, it'll change its name, but it's the National Football League, the NFL, which we have today. He's the first, they called it then president, because his name, not that he was a great administrator or anything, but they knew his name would get newspaper coverage, and it would put professional football beginning to make its mark. It won't really come into its own in this country until the late 1950s with television, and then professional football takes off. Mm-hmm. But he also, going back to like your first question, I believe, he again was this gold standard of athletic achievement. So great collegiate football players wanted to continue playing the game, and they wanted to play with Jim Thorpe, the great Jim Thorpe, who was a great football player. So they flocked to Canton, Ohio. So he continues playing, coaching football, again, into the late 1920s, not necessarily for Canton, for other teams, but he keeps, it's really amazing. I mean, he's playing two or three sports every single year. That's brutal.
Yeah, extraordinary. And so 1912 is always there, I suppose, but it sounds like, even though his name is linked with a sort of infamy, he's a superstar, and it's not like he did anything that bad. So I don't suspect, based on what you're telling me, like Jim Thorpe was walking around feeling ashamed in any way or looked at in that way.
No, except when he got on the baseball field, you know, the New York fans are brutal. They still are, you know, the bleacher creatures, you know, the ones who sit up at the bleachers and drink too much. Really excruciating times for him, I think. Or at bat, those first preliminary years when he's playing for the New York Giants, and they would scream out of the stands, "Why don't you get a bat without a hole in it?" You know, and things like that, taunting him. And that shame on the field was really hard for him. But that's New York. I mean, elsewhere, fathers would take their sons to see exhibition games so they could see the great Jim Thorpe all over the country. And this is how this loyalty to him, when I said your grandfather would remember, he just is embraced as this, as I said, folk hero. But by and large, no, he just kept his head down, you know, and kept working at his sports and earning a living. He had to earn a living after all. He had three marriages and, well, the third came much later, but, you know, several children. So he had a lot on his plate.
Yeah. You said not the most demonstrative character. What else would you say about him? Intelligent, average, funny, good sense of humor, grumpy? What kind of fellow was he?
Oh, he was, I said in the book that he was not a complicated person, but what happened to him was. So he's this Indian kid coming out of Oklahoma, incredibly gifted, loves to move his body, he wasn't really interested in setting records, even though he did, for example, in track and field. He just wanted to be first, particularly in running. He just wanted to beat anybody. And what he would do at Carlisle and in practice for the Olympics, he would vault to the head of everybody else running, and then he'd kind of turn around and look at them and wave as he, you know, continued and became first, kind of taunting them. He loved to play practical jokes. That was one of the favorite things he did. If someone had a brand new, perfectly clean white football uniform, for example, he would just tackle them and rub them in the mud so then it was dirty. Very generous to the very end of his life. If someone, even if he didn't have any money, he would borrow it from somebody and give it to someone who needed the money. Right. He was acutely conscious of what it was like not to have money. Genial, fun-loving, but reserved. And I think you found, and I don't want to generalize here, but many, particularly in white society, many Indians, Native Americans would be like that. They were quiet. They were observant. They were watching their backs.
So retirement's not easy for any sports person, not least, I suspect, when they're truly great. How did he cope? You mentioned Hollywood.
Oh, Hollywood. That's a whole other chapter, which had not really been written about. But this is interesting. You have to remember another really important thing about Thorpe is that I said he played through the 1920s. Here, the 1920s are known, and maybe also in Britain and in Ireland, as the golden age of sports. This is when things start to get organized. Great athletes start to get agents. They start to make real money. They start to do advertising testimonials like, you know, "I love Lucky Strike" as they're smoking, you know, for an ad, and they get paid a lot of money. Thorpe peaked before all that. So he misses this bandwagon of the golden age of sports. And what happens too, during the 1920s, we're going from silent film to talkies, which come in at the very end of the 20s. So the cinema, movies are becoming a bona fide art form and commercial form that is becoming bigger and bigger, and Hollywood becoming more and more important. So what happens is that many athletes, when they can no longer play sports but have any kind of a name, gravitate to Hollywood. And Jim was one of those. And so he goes to Hollywood in the early 30s, and he begins to appear as an extra in all kinds of movies. But also, what's happened of sound, the Western has a rebirth, because you can hear the galloping horses, you can hear the crack of the rifle, you can hear the, you know, thunk of the arrow. So hundreds, thousands even, of Indians also flock to Hollywood because they know how to ride a horse and shoot an arrow and all of that. So they become a staple of the newly reborn American Western, and Thorpe does as well. What he also does is form a casting company to try to pressure the studios to hire real Indians to play Indians, not Greeks and Mexicans and Italians and anybody who looks vaguely ethnic, which the studios didn't care. But he said, no, I my people need jobs. I'm forming this company. So he became, interestingly enough, more in touch with his Indian heritage and background. He starts to go to powwows. He becomes a spokesperson for Indian rights. He really comes into a whole new chapter when he gets to Hollywood.
Does he ever reach leading man status?
No. There are a couple of films where he has some speaking lines. The movie, the one that comes to mind is She, a movie based on the Rider Haggard novel. Really weird story. And he's the captain of the guards, and he has a few lines. No, mostly an extra.
Jim Thorpe dies young at 64. I think he was eating dinner with his wife when he suffered a heart attack. How does he, you know, we're talking early 1950s here when he passes, how does he spend the last 20 or so years of his life?
Well, he stays in and out of Hollywood almost till the very end. A couple of John Ford movies, things like that. He goes in the Merchant Marine in 1945 before World War II is finished. He never served before in World War I. He was exempt because he had a family at that point. And he always felt badly about that. He wanted to serve his country. So he joins the Merchant Marine, and he's sort of traveling around the world, as they did, shipping supplies. And almost as soon as he's in it, World War II is over. So that was brief. He also was in some demand as a speaker for the Chautauqua series here. This is a... Well, it's complicated to explain what it is, but it's a speaking series, and they have different sites of Chautauqua meetings. But people speak about cultural, social, political, economic issues, and he would speak about sports, and he had a standard speech. And the joke was, somebody on the Merchant Marine, when he would start to speak and he had his rote speech, if anybody interrupted him, he had to start all over again because he had a sort of rhythm of saying it. So he made some money from speeches and movies.
Okay, so lived out the end of his days comfortably enough.
Yeah, he he married his third wife, who was difficult, Patsy. He married in 45, and she really took charge of him and decided he was not charging enough for any of this, and he should charge more. And he was comfortable enough, but according to his children, she spent most of it. I don't know. You know, it's difficult to call this. She was not popular with his kids. He also, maybe you were going to get into this, Warner Brothers decided, when Jim Thorpe was named by the Associated Press sports writers as the greatest athlete of then the half 20th century. And again, the memories of him were so fresh, and he's being voted by people who actually saw him play. This was huge. He was the greatest ever again. So Warner Brothers decides to capitalize on this and use one of their newest stars, Burt Lancaster, to play Jim Thorpe, 51, Warner Brothers biopic, Jim Thorpe All-American. So Jim is hired by Warner Brothers, really kind of a gift in a sense, to come on and be a consultant. Burt Lancaster never played football. So Thorpe helped him with some of the moves, minimally. So this was a kind of a mini rebirth in 1950, 51, and the movie comes out. He's again in the headlines, in the spotlight, and deservedly so.
Mm. Wow. What a life.
Yeah, it was. It was. It's what a life. And also, I think one of the most satisfying things about writing this book is that really nothing had been written about him much past, about his life, much past 1912. Mm. And there was so much more. And this doggedness, you know, as I said, of becoming good in baseball, that's to be admired. You know, he was tenacious.
And Kate, a final one, is he still remembered as one of the greats in American sport? Does his name tend to roll off the tongue of, you know, modern day sports commentators if they're listing out the greats of, you know, the best of the best, or has he been forgotten a little bit?
I'd say he's been forgotten a little bit, but it's funny. Your invitation to come speak on this show, and later this afternoon, I'm speaking to some producer about a possible mini series, you know, about his life. It's funny, same with Burt Lancaster. It's like the cycle, the circle turns, and I'd say he's getting more attention now. Maybe people are looking back to the beginning of sports. Since it's gotten so complicated now, and in many ways, in some ways corrupt and blemished, they're looking back to some of the earliest superheroes. So he's getting a second life, or a third life, maybe. Yeah.
Well, if we've piqued people's interest, the name of the book again is Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Kate Buford, brilliant to have you on. Thanks so much for explaining all that to us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Good questions.